From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. School choice has boomed in North Carolina in recent years. We'll hear from an advocate from Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina. He wants to see even more choice options in the years ahead. Some North Carolina lawmakers endorse something called association health plans. They say these plans would help more small businesses provide affordable insurance options for their workers. One high-profile North Carolina congresswoman, Virginia Fox, is drawing attention to the amount of public education spending that pays for administrative bloat. And we'll discuss ways North Carolina could add even more protections in state law against civil asset forfeiture abuse. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
North Carolina's battle over the drawing of election districts has now made its way to the United States Supreme Court. In late March, the justices heard oral arguments in the case known as Rucho v. Common Cause. At the heart of the case is this question: how much partisan advantage is too much partisan advantage when it comes to the drawing of election districts? Carolina Journal Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson is following the case closely. He joins us now. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
Give us a brief synopsis of the challenge to the districts, and which maps are we talking about?
Okay. We're talking about the congressional district maps in North Carolina, and this case was joined by a case from Maryland. And one of the interesting things about this was that the case that Common Cause brought in North Carolina was challenging maps drawn by Republicans, and then the case in Maryland was challenging maps drawn by Democrats. And so you've got both parties involved and competing circuit opinions about this. And so this is one that's attempting to draw everybody in and perhaps set some rules that could be applied nationally, or perhaps not. So that's what we're not really sure about right now. But these are congressional maps that were drawn by Republicans in North Carolina that were declared unconstitutional before the 2018 election cycle. Originally, they had been declared unconstitutional for the 2016 election cycle. A new set came up and the court said, okay, those are fine. These were declared unconstitutional for the 2018 election cycle, but also the courts ruled so late in the process that the Supreme Court said, we're going to let these maps stand in 2018, because if we were to change this now, because we're talking about a September-October decision, if we change these maps at this point, we're going to throw the election system into chaos. This was a federal election, and we're just not going to do that right now. So we'll hear the arguments in a more orderly manner, if you will, after the election's over.
Which they did just a few days ago.
Yes.
What is the challenge by the people who believe that these maps are unconstitutional? Why?
They are arguing that by allowing legislators to draw the maps themselves and to have a process that is run by partisan politicians, that it's possible that they can draw the maps in such a strongly partisan fashion that people of the minority party in a given political district, whether it's a Democratic district or a Republican district, can effectively be disenfranchised, that their voices will not count and will not be heard. They're making an argument under the Equal Protection Clause, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, and saying that basically their votes don't count at all and this violates their rights. And that's the argument they're making both in Maryland and in North Carolina. And in the past, the justices have not considered an equal protection challenge of this nature. So previously they've been largely defined by things like racial animus and things like that, but this is not a challenge based on any kind of civil rights based on, say, the 13th Amendment or something like that.
So Common Cause is challenging the North Carolina maps. Now, who is defending the maps? Republicans drew them, but based on laws and rules, right?
Right, that's right. The Republicans in the General Assembly are being challenged here, and they are using as their justification for drawing the maps, first of all, the fact that the federal courts have never said that too much partisanship is in any way infringing on anyone's rights. They've never made that statement definitively before. They've hinted that there's a possibility that it may happen, but they haven't figured out what standard you would use to determine how much is too much and how you would remedy it, even if you found a standard. And then also they're noting that these particular maps, even the ones drawn for the 2018 cycle, had received clearance from the Department of Justice, which basically said these maps don't violate the Federal Voting Rights Act. These guarantee one person, one vote. They don't violate any restrictions against racial discrimination, that sort of thing. So these are all acceptable for that purpose. They didn't say the maps themselves were acceptable, but they said the criteria used for drawing the maps were acceptable.
Rick, in the oral argument, one of the newest justices, in fact, the newest justice, Brett Kavanaugh, made some comments, asked some questions that are getting a lot of attention.
Yeah, he actually brought up the notion when the Common Cause attorney was, or maybe the Southern Coalition for Social Justice attorney, one of the plaintiff's attorneys said something about, well, proportional representation may be the answer to this. In other words, rather than having a single member represent each district, you would somehow elect a slate of candidates so that the partisan balance between Democrats, Republicans, and even third parties would somehow be honored in the total size of the congressional delegation. So let's say in North Carolina, you might have 7 Democrats and 6 Republicans always in the General Assembly. And Justice Kavanaugh basically said, that's an interesting question. That's something that is worthy of further consideration or something along those lines. And the Common Cause people just started turning cartwheels when that happened, because that's exactly what they've been asking for some time, was that we change a federal law that went into effect in 1967, which says members of Congress have to be elected from single-member districts. You can't have people elected at large in Congress. You can't have multiple people representing the same district. And that was a move that was made, interestingly enough, to prevent Southerners, largely Southern Democrats, from setting up districts to make it almost impossible to elect African Americans to Congress. So this was a way to maintain Jim Crow through the electoral system. And in 1967, Congress said, no, you can't do that.
Are we anticipating that there will be a ruling that somehow sets out some sort of not just a general law or ruling, but a formula of some sort by which districts would be drawn? I mean, how would we possibly go about trying to achieve this idea of competitiveness and fairness?
Well, that's going to be the big challenge for the court. The court may just simply say, look, we've heard these cases now for going on 30 years. Regularly, people bringing up cases challenging whether or not these districts are fair. And from before the founding, the basic theory was these are matters that are best left to the political branches of government. The court's job is just simply to make sure that constitutional rights aren't violated and that this doesn't rise to the level of violating constitutional rights. What you can do is you can say, well, you know what? There are more Republicans than Democrats in the state congressional delegation, but guess what? Republicans have the ability to draw maps to their advantage so long as they abide by one person, one vote. They don't discriminate based on race. The districts all are joined. They are not. You don't have a representative elected from Charlotte who also represents someplace, say, in Greenville or something like that. That you do have the districts maintaining some sense of contiguity. They touch. But basically, this is a political question, and because there's no way to figure out anything that would maintain the level of keeping people's constitutional rights in place, and at the same time not having us back here every time somebody doesn't like a map to try to get us to draw a new formula.
These maps in North Carolina have been challenged in court just year after year after year after year, no matter who draws them.
We have been in this sort of battle continuously pretty much since 1992 in one way or another, by maps drawn by Democrats before 2011 and now by maps drawn by Republicans. And the only way out, it seems to be, is to first of all have the court say, we're not going to address this on the basis of equal protection. And secondly, to say, if you states want to come up with measures that take some of the partisanship out of the process, go for it. And that's what there are some reformers in North Carolina who are trying to do right now.
When do we expect a decision?
It should be probably as the justices are getting on their planes to leave for the summer so they don't have to deal much with it. So it'll be the last day of the session, which will be right around the end of June.
All right. We'll have you back to assess exactly what they decide. Rick Henderson, editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. School choice has been booming in North Carolina in recent years, and one group that's played an important role in that boom is Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina, PEFNC. That group's president, Mike Long, joins us now, and he's going to discuss what lies ahead in the new year. Welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back.
So first of all, before we get into what PEFNC is going to be doing in 2019, remind us why school choice is so important to people here in North Carolina.
It empowers parents to make the right decisions for their children as far as their education is concerned. It gives them the freedom to choose what is best for their child. And who knows better what is best for their child? So PEFNC is out there engaging them in the community to help them understand that there are all kinds of choices. We're strong advocates of the public schools. We want them to improve and get better, but also charter schools, private schools, home schools, whatever the choice of that parent is one that we should build in North Carolina, and we're doing that quite well. We are educating parents of all of the options that are available and also empowering them to make the best decision. We're grateful for the impact that we've had from the legislature as far as the funds that have been made available in scholarship opportunities for parents. So I love the fact that it's educational freedom. It frees parents to make the right choices for their children.
And I want to loop back to something you said earlier, because I think some people may hear about the school choice and the school choice movement and think that this is some sort of attack on the public schools.
Not at
all. You mentioned very early on that you were interested in the traditional district schools succeeding. How does school choice help with that?
Yeah, I'm a product of the public schools. I grew up in the Durham public schools. I taught in the public schools, but I've also taught in private schools. I've been a principal. I'm a head of school. The beautiful thing about it is there are all kinds of options. You know, our educational system was built during the Industrial Revolution. It's archaic. And when we talk about reform, it scares a lot of people. A lot of times reform means do away with, and that's not what we're talking about at all. We're talking about making it better in the age of technology and where we are in the 21st century. So we want public schools to succeed. We want them to get better. We want to pay good teachers to be in those classrooms. We want reduced class size. But we also know that not every traditional public school works well for every family that lives in the zip code that they're required to attend. And so we feel like they should have the freedom as well to choose what school works best for their child as parents.
We are chatting with Mike Long. He is president of Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina. You might know the group by the acronym PEFNC. So Parents for Educational Freedom has been involved in this school choice movement on a number of different levels. What are some of the priorities for this year ahead?
Well, I want to see it expand because not only does it improve the traditional public schools, it gives everyone options, and it also grows the economy. This is one thing that I'm really looking into. When you have failed schools in a particular community, parents are generally going to gravitate to where the good schools are. And so a lot of them will leave that community, particularly the middle class who can, perhaps. They'll leave that community, and along with them goes businesses and other things. And so the community tends to fail in a lot of these areas. So when we offer school choice, and it is in those areas, we find that not only do they come back, they're going to gravitate to where that good school is, and that's where they want to live. That's where businesses will come back to. But if you're out of that community and you're trapped because you don't have the economic ability to make that move, then we've got a big problem, and therefore there's the poverty. There's the, you know, the community's on the decline. So school choice grows the economy. School choice builds a better community. And that's one thing that we want to focus on as well in North Carolina, particularly in communities that do have failed schools. How can we improve them? And how can we give parents the freedom to come back to that area where good schools are and grow the community, grow the economy? That's a benefit for everybody. That's nothing but win-win across the board.
It sounds as if you're going to be focusing attention on this, maybe studying the issue to find out a little bit more about the links between choice and the economy.
That's right. What we're finding is wherever the good schools are, that's where families want to be, and they want to live near the good schools. You know, the other thing, too, if the good schools are outside of the city, let's say, many will move out to that area, but yet they still work in the city. So they have to drive back and forth, and we wonder why our highways are so crowded. You know, there's one person in every car. We wonder why, you know, the CO2 emissions are growing so much. School choice helps the environment. So if you're able to have good schools in a community where people will gravitate, live, grow, and then businesses come back to that community because that's where people are, and then you don't have to be out there on the highways going back and forth so many miles because of where you work. Again, that's a benefit for everyone. That's benefiting parents, it's benefiting children, it's benefiting the economy, and it's benefiting the environment. And that's all about school choice.
Parents for Educational Freedom has been involved in a number of the choice programs that North Carolina has, the Disability Student Scholarship, mm-hmm. the Opportunity Scholarship, the Education Savings Account.
Right.
Do you hope to see these programs expanded or tweaked in any way?
Yes, we do hope to see them expanded because, again, the more they expand, it benefits all. And that includes the traditional public school because they will need to improve as well, and we want to help them improve as well. So when you talk about the disability scholarship, you talk about children who need to be in schools that can meet their needs. And what we're hearing from principals now across the state, they're saying, because this child, this particular student has been able to come to our school, yes, we're able to help that student, but you would not believe how much that student has helped the remainder of our student body for them to have a better acknowledgement of special needs, handicap, and develop that with other children to go so that it's not a bullying situation, which can often occur, and they have more caring of that individual. So we've had parents to tell us because of the disability, learning disability scholarships, those kids that have come into their student body, it's not that they have helped them so much, which they do. It is how much those students have helped the rest of the student body. So that's a win-win again.
And we've got the opportunity scholarships, also the education savings accounts. In the brief amount of time that we have left, is there a particular challenge that you want to work on too? I mean, we know that school choice faces some attacks. Mm-hmm. Are there challenges that you're going to be focusing on as well?
Continuing to educate legislators. Those in the, you know, in the General Assembly, you know, I have never seen an issue, Mitch, that brings both sides of the aisle together so much as this one as well. Because again, it's benefiting all people. It's definitely helping those that are poor. It's helping those that are in need, those that feel trapped. It frees them from that, and it gives them the same opportunity as others may have who have the means to move to a school that can be the best school for their child. So we're finding that we're able to reach across the aisle on this issue very well, and we're finding bipartisan support in all of these scholarships. So interesting in a political environment that's so polarized, I know of no other issue that brings people together than school choice, education reform.
Well, everyone wants to see what's best for their kids, whether it's in the traditional schools or in one of these options that parents increasingly have in North Carolina. As school choice continues to grow, we know that one group that's going to be paying attention and helping to drive that change is Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina. And we thank its president, Mike Long, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some North Carolina lawmakers want to make it easier for small business owners to offer their workers health insurance. Republican State Senator Dan Bishop explains how.
Offering high-quality health insurance to the employees of small businesses especially is something that many small business owners simply cannot afford. Small businesses with fewer than 51 employees are not required to offer health benefits, but of course, we'd like them to as often as possible. Studies show half of them don't offer coverage because of the cost. Historically, this is because small businesses don't enjoy the same regulatory advantages as large corporations when it comes to offering health benefits to their employees. We will file the Small Business Health Care Act, which will give small businesses a cost-effective option to offer their employees high-quality health insurance plans. The main thing that the Small Business Health Care Act does is loosen current restrictions on association health plans, or AHPs, which allow a group of small businesses to band together and form a large group, which can then receive many of the same benefits that large corporations receive when it comes to offering health benefits to employees. Before 2010, AHPs were an option that small businesses around the country used to offer insurance to their employees. But an Obama administration guidance changed this. Shortly after the passage of Obamacare in 2010, a slew of more expensive restrictions burdened the small group insurance market. Regulators were concerned that in order to escape these expensive and burdensome Obamacare restrictions on the small group market, more small businesses would turn to AHPs. To force these businesses onto the small group market, the Obama administration guidance required each small business within an AHP to have at least 51 employees, unless all businesses within the AHP were in the same industry and located in the same geographic area.
The new legislation takes advantage of a Trump administration order. It reverses those Obama-era restrictions. Senator Joyce Krawczyk discusses the potential benefits.
By making these changes, this bill will open up an entirely new avenue for small business owners to offer insurance to their employees and sole proprietors to insure themselves and their families. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, these modifications to North Carolina's code could potentially benefit up to 110,000 North Carolinians.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent news conference about association health plans. Supporters tout those plans as a way to help more North Carolina small businesses provide health insurance to workers. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Democrats in charge of the U.S. House's Education Committee recently focused attention on crumbling American schools. During the hearing, the committee's ranking Republican highlighted her own ideas. Virginia Fox represents North Carolina's 5th Congressional District.
Teachers work hard on behalf of American students and families, and they deserve paychecks that reflect their tireless efforts. And all students deserve access to safe, clean, and healthy school facilities, regardless of zip code. To dispute these two facts would make anyone out of touch with reality. Over the past year, there's been a steady stream of well-publicized strikes across the country. Teachers' unions in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Colorado, Arizona, Los Angeles, and most recently Denver all called attention to these matters. So given the recent uptick in teachers' union strikes, a reasonable person would assume that state and local governments are cutting budgets and disinvesting in public schools. Quite the contrary. In fact, most states have actually increased public school spending, but instead of increasing salaries, improving structures, and investing in classroom equipment, many school districts have ended up pouring taxpayer funds into administrative bloat that leaves students and teachers high and dry.
Fox questioned the most common response to complaints about underfunded public schools.
It's been said that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. When it comes to these two issues, teacher pay and school construction, Democrats have not had a new idea in decades. Anytime a challenge arises, Democrats look to refill the same prescription of more money, more bureaucracy, and more power punted to distant figures in Washington. Is the answer more control from Washington? Well, having just emerged from a government shutdown, I think most Americans would agree that the less politicians can control and leverage, the better. Teachers and students deserve more than the same tired fights over money. We need to find new and innovative approaches to public school success. Republicans still and will always believe that the best solutions for serving children emerge from the communities in which they live and grow.
That's U.S. Representative Virginia Fox, Republican from North Carolina's 5th Congressional District. Fox used part of her time at a recent House Education Committee to question Ben Scafidi, an economics professor at Kennesaw State University in Georgia.
I appreciate that your testimony backs up my impression, which is that teacher salaries have not kept pace with the cost of living. I can understand why teachers are upset. Unfortunately, your research shows that all the activism from teachers is generating public education spending, which is largely directed away from instruction. If you were advising teachers how they should approach negotiations with state and local leaders, what would you suggest they advocate for to ensure that new resources benefit them?
There are powerful forces in the public education system driving this increase in all other staff. And so if teachers, you know, their priorities should be what their priorities are, but if their priority is salaries, they should focus on that issue. Because my kids are in public school in Georgia, and I wrote a paper about what I called the 13-layer cake. There are 13 layers of public officials that have a say in what goes on in my children's classroom. Congress, the president, Secretary of Education, U.S. Department of Education, governor, state house. We have a bunch of state education agencies, school board. All of them have policy priorities, and all those policy priorities might be great. But what it's led to over many decades is an increase in all other staff. If teachers want salary increases, they should focus like a laser beam on that.
Representative Virginia Fox pointed to another element of Scafidi's research into education spending.
You've pointed out that since 1992, public education has received a 37% increase in real resources. And you've pointed out that student performance has significantly changed over that time. And yet we're constantly told that if we just spend a little more, we'll unlock the secret to vast improvements in performance. Do you think you could highlight for me the level of magical spending we need to see an increase in performance?
You can always grab a study that says if we increase spending by X, we'll get an achievement increase of Y. Right. And some of those studies are well done by great researchers with great data, great methods, great research designs, what have you. But then when you look at the spending increases that they say will lead to this increase in achievement, then in the real world, we typically increase spending by even more than that. And the achievement gains don't materialize. So it's perhaps ironic that the economist is saying we need to look at the real world. If in the real world, spending increases aren't translating into achievement gains, then we've got to question that research. So there is no magic number.
Fox also asked Scafidi to compare pay of K-12 public school teachers with that of college professors.
Elementary and secondary education teachers should be paid more and college professors should be paid less because the teachers at the elementary and secondary have the tougher job. I believe K-12 teachers have a harder job, but I also know that post-secondary salaries are much more market-driven. Are there steps that state and local policymakers could take that would make teachers' salaries more market-responsive?
Yes, in higher ed, our salaries are largely market-driven. Disciplines like business, law, medicine, engineering that have good outside options, even economics, we're paid quite well. Disciplines like the humanities that have less good outside options, actually, they probably would, financially, would have been better off being a K-12 teacher instead of spending all that time and money getting a PhD. So for humanities professors, it's rough. So how could we make teacher salaries more market-driven? All the rage in policy debates is about monopsonistic labor markets, one buyer of labor. The most monopsonistic labor market in the United States is the public education system, because in a community or even a county, you have one buyer of labor that's the big player. And when there's one buyer of labor in any walk of life, the workers can be exploited. We need to have a more market-driven education system, and then teachers will get paid more and they'll be treated a lot better.
Fox returned to her key theme that education spending increases need to focus on teachers.
Teachers and students deserve the best working and learning environments money can buy. And if the money we're spending at every level of government isn't buying what students need, the answer isn't more money.
What about policies that boost economic growth?
We've barely touched in this hearing on the historic economic growth communities are experiencing and what that means for local revenues. You know there's more to Main Street than small businesses. There are an awful lot of schools on Main Street, too. Perhaps we need to spend more time thinking about how to reform the system to better use the resources we already have. I'm certain that if we put our heads together, we could find a new idea that would actually work for students that just might enter the realm of fiscal responsibility.
That's U.S. Representative Virginia Fox, Republican from North Carolina's 5th District. She's responding to recent concerns from her Democratic colleagues about crumbling American schools. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Depriving criminals of their ill-gotten gains is clearly a desirable goal for society. The challenge, however, says our next guest, is to do that in a way that protects the rights of innocent property owners and discourages abuse by law enforcement agencies. Fact is, that can be a problem, but some states are leading the way in trying to prevent it. John Guzet is Director of Legal Studies at the John Locke Foundation, and he has just released a new report on what is technically known as asset forfeiture. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
First of all, North Carolina does have a law about this issue, and it protects us, but you say that that's not enough. Help us understand where North Carolina is on this issue.
Well, our asset forfeiture laws are actually among the very best in the country. Under North Carolina's criminal forfeiture statute, before property can be taken from somebody who's suspected of having used it or acquired it through a crime, that person has to be accused and convicted, and it has to be shown that the property really was connected with the crime in some way. That's very good. That protects the innocent, and it also discourages abuse. And another factor that discourages abuse in North Carolina is this. Law enforcement agencies cannot keep the property or the proceeds from property that they acquire through forfeiture under North Carolina law. Instead, the proceeds have to be used for public education. That's very good because it takes away the incentive to abuse the system, which has been a huge problem in many other states.
And in fact, in your report, you do point out that North Carolina actually leads in terms of protections, but that the federal government has some other laws and some other ways of doing things that allow, in some cases, law enforcement agencies to kind of skirt North Carolina law.
That's right. It's called circumvention. And the way it works is this. Under a program called equitable sharing, state and local law enforcement agencies can use federal law to process seized assets, and then they get to keep all or part of the proceeds from those forfeitures.
John, is this a problem in North Carolina?
Well, I don't think it's a problem. At least if it is, it's not a huge problem. We've looked and we haven't really found very many instances in which this process has been abused by North Carolina law enforcement agencies. There's been a few, but overall, our law enforcement agencies have maintained their integrity. And part of the reason they have, where other states have slipped into abusive police practices, is because we have these good protections under North Carolina law. What we think is important is to ensure that law enforcement agencies in North Carolina aren't tempted to use this federal anti-circumvention process as a way to get around North Carolina protections and in that way be led into bad and abusive practices.
Help us understand how the federal law works. Under what circumstances can a law enforcement agency in a state actually work with the feds?
Well, there's actually two ways state and local law enforcement agencies can take advantage of equitable sharing. The first way is if they're involved in some kind of a joint task force or a joint investigation with a federal agency. When that happens, if property is forfeited under federal law, that property gets shared, or the proceeds from selling that property actually gets shared between the feds and the state agencies according to a formula that's based on how many hours each department has worked and so on. That's one way. The other way is through a process called adoptions. Now, the adoptions program really exists only for one purpose, and that is to circumvent state laws. The way adoptions works is a state law enforcement agency can seize property, and instead of processing under state law with all the protections provided there, they can simply have it adopted by a federal agency, perhaps by the Department of Justice or the Department of the Treasury. It'll get processed under federal law, and then they get 80% of the proceeds back. The feds weren't involved in this law enforcement operation at all. Their only job was basically to launder the proceeds through the federal system, and they keep 20% for their services.
Now, I'm not an attorney, and I'm not in law enforcement, but when I hear you describe those two ways, John, the first one, the joint investigations, frankly sounds okay to me. It sounds like you've had the federal government and a state or local law enforcement agency work together to try to get a bad guy off the street. And then the assets that were used as part of that criminal activity, they've split the proceeds. Does that seems fair?
It is. Well, let me look at it a different way. Certainly, everybody wants state and law enforcement agencies to be able to cooperate with the feds when there's a law enforcement purpose in doing so. And one of the difficulties that states have had in trying to frame anti-circumvention legislation is to do it in a way that doesn't prevent that. So everybody agrees we do want joint investigations. We do want our agencies to work with the feds. The question is, what happens if there's assets seized in the process? What we don't want is that for a joint investigation to be an opportunity for state and local law enforcement to circumvent the state laws. And that's what some of these other states have come up with ways to avoid that.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because I know you're going to be writing another report here shortly about North Carolina and how we can address this issue in our state. What have we learned from other states? You've come up with three particular lessons, and one is this: to ban or severely restrict federal adoptions, because that really, you're zeroing in on that adoptions process.
I am, for a couple of reasons. The main one is that there's simply no legitimate purpose for it. Adoptions serve only one purpose, and that's to circumvent state law, so that we don't need them. If somebody suspects that a property has been used for a crime, they can seize that property and they can forfeit it under state law. There's no reason to go through federal law other than the fact that if they go through federal law, they don't have to charge or convict the property's owner. They don't have to show a nexus with the crime, and they get to keep the proceeds. That's very important. If they process it under state law in North Carolina, the proceeds go to public education. If they process it through the federal system, they get to keep those proceeds.
And no one would want a profit motive to become high on the priority list when you're talking about public safety and law enforcement.
Absolutely not. What we've seen in other states where they don't have the protections we have here is we end up with what I call predatory policing. It turns the police into predators, and it turns the public into their prey. That's the opposite of what we want from law enforcement.
That's lesson number one. You also write about this recommendation: that don't divert forfeiture proceeds away from law enforcement.
Yes, the reason we don't want to do that, I mean, at first glance, you might just think, well, let's just insist that the same thing happens as happens under North Carolina law. Even if they process it through federal law, they still have to turn it over to public education. That won't work, unfortunately, because there's federal rules that say forfeiture proceeds can only be used for law enforcement purposes. Now, I'm sure that that rule was put in place thinking that it was a good idea, but what it does is it prevents the best way of protecting the public in North Carolina. So other states that have done this have found that once they've put that kind of rule in place, the feds won't cooperate with them in joint investigations. We don't want that.
And John, you also write that some states have been trying to experiment with what are known as minimum thresholds in order to figure out exactly when to get involved in this type of thing and when not to. How does that work?
That seems to be the most promising approach to continuing to cooperate with the feds in joint investigations, but avoiding the possibility of abuse. And the way these thresholds work is they say if the forfeited amount is below a certain threshold, either you can't send it to the feds or you can't keep the proceeds. Both ways have their advantages and their disadvantages, but since the vast majority of forfeitures are for small amounts, putting in a threshold protects a lot of people. But because most of the actual revenue comes from the large forfeitures, it doesn't jeopardize the process.
We've been talking with John Guzet. He is the Director of Legal Studies for the John Locke Foundation. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.